There's a story that in the spring of 1683, Kara Mustafa, the Grand Vizier of the Ottoman Turks, awoke from a terrible nightmare. In the dream, the vizier had walked out his door and put new boots on his feet. Then he looked up, and standing in front of him was a ferocious seven-headed dragon. Mustafa froze in that way that you can only freeze in a dream, and the dragon had its way with him. It started by stamping the vizier under his mighty feet. Once he'd been completely trampled, the dragon then opened his massive jaws and bit down hard on the flattened Mustafa. With that, the vizier awoke with a start. This dream clearly had a meaning, so he went to consult with a well-known soothsayer. The soothsayer told him that the dream had a very clear message. He was told that the boots he was wearing signified the departure for a long military campaign. The dragon was obviously the Habsburg Caesar, the Holy Roman Emperor. It had seven heads, you see, because the Habsburg ruler was easily pushed around by the kings he was supposed to control. Specifically, he was subservient to seven German kings, or so said the soothsayer. Now, the fact that Kara Mustafa had been trampled and then bitten by this dragon, well, that was much more worrying. This meant that the military campaign he was about to go on was sure to be a disaster. The soothsayer told Mustafa that if he was wise, he wouldn't march towards the lands of the Habsburgs. But the story tells us that Kara Mustafa was not one bit intimidated by these evil omens. Indeed, he had been planning a great military campaign against the Austrians. And no dream, no matter how terrifying, was going to keep him from his goal. Now, this story probably isn't true, but there's something compelling about it. A general getting an evil omen on the eve of a battle, it's very Shakespearean. Indeed, the events set in motion by Kara Mustafa and his sultan Mehmed IV in 1683 were nothing short of dramatic. They are totally worthy of a Shakespeare play. In that year, the Ottoman army would fling its full might at the walls of Vienna, the Austrian Habsburg capital and the home of the Holy Roman Emperor. This event was so epic in its scope and dramatic in its conclusion that it became more than a historical event. It became a thing of myth. It's so epic, in fact, that J.R.R. Tolkien is actually thought to have borrowed from it when he was writing Lord of the Rings. In Tolkien's mind, the final battle in The Return of the King was just a fantasy version of the real Battle of Vienna. An event of this scope has a way of giving birth to legends both big and small. In this story, there are myths about the destinies of civilizations, and local legends about the invention of certain pastries. Was the 1683 Siege of Vienna really the ultimate clash of East versus West? Were the Ottoman Turks really intent on destroying Christian Europe? Did men with wings on their backs really save the day at the last minute? And did all of this end with the birth of the cappuccino? This is our fake history. Episode number 44, What Went Down at the Siege of Vienna, Part 1. Hello and welcome to Our Fake History. My name is Sebastian Major, and this is the show where we look at historical myths and try and figure out what's fact, what's fiction, and what is such a good story that it simply must be told. This week we are diving into a topic that for many of you might not be the most recognizable. Well, Actually, I should qualify that. Your familiarity with this particular story has everything to do with what part of the world you happen to live in. For anyone out there listening in Europe, you might be a little bit better versed in the ins and outs of this particular event. If you happen to be Austrian, Turkish, Hungarian, or Polish, then this story may actually be very close to your heart. However, in North America, this event is pretty obscure. In this part of the world, only our most dedicated history buffs and serious students of European history have ever heard of the 1683 Siege of Vienna. Now, this is a serious shame, because this siege is one of the most fascinating and dramatic moments in European history, like, maybe ever. It was a pivotal moment in what was a centuries-long struggle between two of the most consequential empires of the age, the Ottoman Turks and the Holy Roman Empire ruled by the Austrian Habsburgs. Now, we will get into who all those people were in a minute, but right now I'm sure you're asking, what does this have to do with fake history? I mean, come on, Seb, what's the historical myth? Well, in this case, there isn't just one exaggerated legend or popular historical misconception. Instead, the Siege of 1683 is the setting of literally dozens of historical myths. Some of these myths deal with huge things, like how an entire culture was perceived by Europe, while others deal with very small things, like the curious origins of drinks and snacks. The fact that there are so many legends, big and small, that are set during the Siege of Vienna is a testament to how important an event this actually was in history. So here's how we're going to approach it. I'm going to tell you the story of the siege, and we'll address as many myths as we can as they pop up in the narrative. Now, this is a big story, so, ladies and gentlemen, I think we're looking at another trilogy, so buckle up. Now, before we can get into the bloody madness that is the actual siege, I think it's wise to get a bit of context, and so that's what today's show is going to be about. To fully understand why this event was so dramatic and ultimately so legendary, we need to understand what exactly was at stake, or at least what people thought was at stake. We need to explore who the key players were in this event, so when all hell breaks loose, we can keep the game straight. As I said earlier, this conflict was primarily between the Ottoman Turks and the Austrian Habsburgs. But by the time it was all over, this conflict would draw in the Tartars from Crimea, the Kingdom of Poland, and a whole smattering of Germans. But let's start by looking at the two most important players, the Turks and the Habsburgs. So, who were the Ottoman Turks? Well, by 1683, they were certainly in the running for the title of most powerful empire in the world. Now, obviously, it hadn't always been that way. The Turks had started their existence as one of the many warrior groups to emerge from the Central Asian steppe. Much like the Mongols, the Huns, or the Scythians, they had been a nomadic people who had perfected a certain type of warfare that relied on mounted archers as their main battle unit. After the armies of Islam exploded out of the Arabian Peninsula and conquered much of West Asia, it wasn't long before missionaries made their way to the steppe and managed to convert the Turkish tribes to their new religion. But despite their obvious devotion to Islam, the Turks would never fully absorb Arab culture. Their faith would always carry elements of their earlier steppe religion, and their culture would never fully lose touch with its nomadic roots. even as the Turks became a thoroughly urban society. In the medieval era, different groups of Turks would end up conquering much of what is today modern Iran, and eventually Anatolia. When European crusaders first swept into the Holy Land, the people they were fighting were a group known as the Seljuk Turks. Well, their regime would finally fall when the Mongols swept through the region and made them their vassals. But eventually, in the early 1300s, an ambitious warlord from Anatolia, by the name of Osman, started capturing Byzantine towns and carving out a small power base in what would eventually become northern Turkey. It's Osman who gives his name to the massive empire that would grow out of this modest territory. From Osman, we get the Ottomans. In the century after Osman's death, his successors would steadily expand their territory in Anatolia, and significantly, into Europe. In fact, the Ottomans were able to build an empire in the Balkans and Greece well before they started expanding into the Middle East. The common myth about the Ottomans was that they were a thoroughly Eastern people who were alien invaders in Europe. Now, although this is somewhat true, it ignores the fact that the Ottomans were actually more of a European empire before they were an Asian empire, at least geographically speaking. But the defining moment in Ottoman history most certainly came in 1453, when the Sultan Mehmed II, aka Mehmed the Conqueror, led his victorious armies into the ancient city of Constantinople. Yes, after building one of the largest cannons to have ever been built, the Ottomans battered down the previously invincible walls of Constantinople and entered the last city controlled by the Roman Empire. So, those of you out there taking bets on what year the Roman Empire actually fell, there's pretty good money on the year 1453. But, as we're going to get into, even that turns out to be kind of controversial. Nonetheless, it's hard to understate how symbolic the capture of Constantinople was. For the Turks, it symbolized their arrival as one of the world's great empires. They now controlled the new Rome, ostensibly making them the new Roman emperors. Before the fall of the city, the Turks had already been an important military force, and to be honest, Constantinople itself wasn't really the most important objective militarily, but as a trophy, it didn't really get much better. Let me put it this way. When you take one of the most ancient and important churches in Christendom, Constantinople's Hagia Sophia, and you transform it into a mosque, that's a pretty big deal. The significance of this certainly was not lost on Europe. While the Turks had been regarded as a heathen enemy since the time of the Crusades, the fall of the Byzantine Empire was seen as nothing less than a disaster for Christianity. From this point on, the Turks would occupy a uniquely terrifying place in the European imagination. They represented a real challenge to the kingdoms of Europe, militarily, economically, culturally, and religiously. It should perhaps then come as no surprise that European depictions of the Turks always painted them as bloodthirsty monsters bent on the enslavement of all Christians. Now, we're going to come back to this idea because, as you might imagine, it's deeply connected to many of the myths and misconceptions about the Ottomans. The European perception of the Turks needs to be unpacked if we're going to understand the central myth of 1683. So tuck that in your back pocket for now. Now, to be fair, after 1453, the Turks' neighbors had some reason to feel threatened. The successors of Mehmed the Conqueror would steadily build on his successes, and eventually the Ottoman Empire would cover most of what had once been the Eastern Roman Empire. The Ottomans would conquer Mesopotamia and would take the cultural hub of Baghdad. They would conquer the west coast of the Arabian Peninsula and raise their banners over Mecca and Medina. They would take North Africa, and under the leadership of one of their most famous sultans, Suleiman the Magnificent, they would push ever deeper into Europe. Now, Suleiman is a pretty incredible character in his own right and is probably deserving of his own podcast. In an era that was filled with big personalities, he still manages to distinguish himself as one of the biggest. And this is a guy who counted England's Henry VIII, King Francis of France, and the Holy Roman Emperor Charles V as his contemporaries. In Turkish, he was known as Suleiman the Lawgiver because of his reforms to the empire's legal and educational systems. But I think it's pretty telling that his title, the Magnificent, wasn't given to him by his fellow Turks. That's what the Europeans called him. But for the purposes of our story, all we need to know is that in the course of his long reign in the mid-1500s, he managed to conquer a number of formerly Christian territories. These included the island of Rhodes, the city of Belgrade, and most of central and eastern Hungary, including the city of Buda. By the end of Suleiman's reign, the Turks were knocking on the door of Austria and Central Europe. This meant that directly in their line of fire was one of the continent's most important royal families, the Habsburgs. So, who were the Habsburgs? Well, for a family that would end up being so important in the history of Europe, they have somewhat obscure origins. They were originally a minor medieval aristocratic family that seems to have taken their name from Habsburg Castle, a family estate in what is today modern Switzerland. But they first really made their mark on the European scene in the late 1200s. This is when Rudolf I of House Habsburg, through a combination of well-timed military victories and some clever political machinations, managed to get himself crowned King of Germany in 1273. This also came with the very cool title King of the Romans. Now, despite these very grandiose sounding titles, this basically meant that Rudolf was able to bring what is today Austria and large chunks of southern Germany under his control. Now, amazingly, his descendants would have complete dominion over this swath of Central Europe for the next 600 years. Rudolf was also the first Habsburg to make a play for the title Holy Roman Emperor. But unfortunately for Rudolf, he was never actually able to lock it down because the Pope was never able to sign off on the whole thing. Now, the position of Holy Roman Emperor is weird and super complicated. When describing it, historians are always drawn to Voltaire's witty little quote, that the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy nor Roman nor an empire. As I mentioned in our last episode, and that was our exploration of phantom time for those of you who are keeping track, the title of Holy Roman Emperor was originally given to Charlemagne in 800 AD and was sold as the second coming of the Western Roman Empire. But by the late medieval period, being Holy Roman Emperor basically meant that you were the nominal ruler of a loose collection of German states, each of which was pretty independent. To become Holy Roman Emperor, you actually had to be elected by a group of German princes. That's why there were a bunch of German nobles who had the weird title Elector. You could be the Elector of Saxony. When the old Holy Roman Emperor died, the electors would get together and elect a new one, and the whole thing was then blessed by the Pope. Well, by the mid-1400s, the Habsburgs had basically arranged things with the electors, i.e. bribed them, so someone from their family got elected Holy Roman Emperor every time. From then on in, it was basically a hereditary title, despite the ongoing pomp of rigged elections and papal blessings. But the real secret to the success of the Habsburgs was their clever use of marriage alliances. The Austrian Habsburgs got very good at strategically marrying their sons and daughters into the other major royal families of Europe. There is even a little saying about this in the 1400s that went, quote, "Let others wage war. Thou, happy Austria, marry," end quote. The only negative consequences of these clever marriage alliances were that the Habsburgs often ended up marrying, well, other Habsburgs. Generations of inbreeding meant that recessive genes often started to manifest in their sons and daughters. The most famous example of this would have to be the Habsburg chin. If you look at any portraits from this era, you can always spot a Habsburg because of the way the lower half of their face just juts out. If you don't believe me, look it up. But despite this, these strategic marriages eventually created a situation where one Habsburg prince basically inherited two-thirds of Europe. This was the famous Charles V. Charles would inherit all the Austrian Habsburg lands, huge hunks of southern Italy, and basically all of Belgium and the Netherlands. On top of that, he would inherit the throne of Spain and all of its colonies in the New World. And of course, he would eventually pick up the title Holy Roman Emperor, giving him nominal control over most of Central Europe. In other words, Charles was a pretty big deal. When he considered Spain's claims to all of North and South America and eventually the Philippines, Charles could basically claim that he ruled half the world. Now, one really interesting thing to me about this story is that our two opposing dynasties basically experienced their golden age right at the same moment. Charles V and Suleiman the Magnificent are contemporaries and both presided over their empires during incredible periods of expansion. What's also kind of baffling is that both guys also claimed to be the Emperor of Rome. Yes, in all of these conflicts between the Ottomans and the Habsburgs, one of the things that's at stake is who is the real Roman Emperor? Turns out, those of you who thought that the Roman Empire finally collapsed in 1453 might have actually been wrong. You see, both the Habsburgs and the Ottomans thought that they were the rightful holders of the title Emperor of Rome, and both of them saw it as their destiny to restore the unity of that former empire. The Ottomans believed that they had claimed the title by right of conquest. When they deposed the last Byzantine emperor and took Constantinople, they also took his imperial title. And, as we said earlier, the Habsburgs had gained the title by way of complicated rigged elections and the blessing of the Pope. It frustrated the Ottomans to no end that the Habsburgs, who they regarded as merely German dukes, were parading around with their hard-won imperial title. So yeah, the Roman Empire. I mean, I'm always amazed at how resilient it was as an idea. But anyway, it was during the reigns of Charles and Suleiman that the Habsburg-Ottoman rivalry really took root. Suleiman's relentless campaigning in Eastern Europe would eventually bring the Turkish army to Habsburg-controlled lands. For the most part, Suleiman's forces were incredibly successful, and they managed to conquer most of Habsburg-controlled Hungary, including the capital of Buda. From there, Suleiman set his eyes on what he knew would be an even greater prize. If he could capture Vienna, the eastern capital and home to the Austrian wing of the Habsburg family, he could deal a humiliating defeat to one of the few European monarchs that could challenge the power of the Turks. So, Suleiman attempted not once, but twice to take the city of Vienna. Once in 1529, and then again in 1532. But despite his best efforts, the Ottomans were always held at bay by a combination of solid defenses, reliable relief armies, and sometimes just bad weather. So even though Suleiman certainly got the better of the Habsburgs by gobbling up large swaths of their eastern territory, his inability to capture Vienna remained a sore spot. From then on, the city of Vienna would occupy a unique place in the Turkish imagination. It was the one stronghold that the great Suleiman, the lawgiver, had been unable to conquer. As a result, it became a tempting prize for all future sultans. For the Turks, the city of Constantinople had been called the Red Apple, and capturing it had been a defining moment in their history. After Suleiman, Vienna became known as the Golden Apple. If it could be plucked from the tree, then the Sultan who did it would live forever in the annals of Turkish history. By the time we get to 1683, there had been well over 150 years of on-and-off violence between the Habsburgs and the Ottomans. In those years, the empires had changed. After Charles V, no one person would ever again be the master of both Spain and the Austrian territories. The Habsburgs had split into Spanish and Austrian branches. Now, the Austrian side of the family had managed to keep the title Holy Roman Emperor, but that empire really wasn't what it used to be. The Protestant Reformation had sown division amongst the German states, and the violence of the Thirty Years' War had nearly destroyed the empire entirely. The Habsburgs narrowly emerged from that conflict, still possessing their now thoroughly hereditary title, but their power over Germany was tenuous at best. On top of that, they were now facing a threat on their western flank from France under the rule of the Sun King, Louis XIV. The emperor in 1683 was Leopold I. He was a competent, if unambitious, character who basically fit the profile of a pampered kid from an old conservative family. He wasn't bad, believe me, there were worse Habsburgs, but he wasn't great. At times, he even seemed unsure and perhaps cowardly. The historian Andrew Wheatcroft, who is a master of colorful adjectives, calls him, quote, tremulous, which is a beautiful $10 word if I've ever heard one. All of this is to say that on the eve of the 1683 Siege of Vienna, the Golden Apple looked like it might just be ripe for plucking. So what was going on with the Ottomans in these years? Well, the answer to that question is a little more complicated. If you were to look at a map of the Ottoman Empire, it would look like it was stronger than ever. In 1683, the empire encompassed more territory than it ever would in its history. But despite its outward appearance of strength, not all was well with the Ottomans. In the 100 years since Suleiman, the Ottoman leadership had been patchy at best. The Sultan who would eventually make his play for Vienna in 1683 was Mehmed IV, and he had succeeded some pretty sketchy sultans. His immediate predecessor had been Ibrahim I, who was later nicknamed Ibrahim the Mad by Western historians. Ibrahim seems to have been quite mentally ill. We're told that he lived most of his early life in a cell, terrified that he might be murdered at any minute by his brother, the Sultan. When his brother eventually died, he was let out of the cell and was suddenly the most powerful man in the empire. But his years of mistreatment had left him scarred. He was apparently so paranoid that his brother wasn't actually dead that he insisted on inspecting the dead corpse for hours before he could calm his nerves. And believe it or not, that's not even one of the crazy stories. If we're to believe the tales about Ibrahim, then his years in captivity had made him a bit of a sexual deviant. The story goes that he spent nearly all of his time in the harem and was fed aphrodisiacs by his own mother to keep him distracted while she ran the empire. One particularly nasty story has it that at one point he became suspicious that someone had broken into the harem and had his way with the harem girls. He had a number of the girls tortured, but no information could be gleaned. So in a fit of paranoia, he had all 280 of the harem women stuffed into burlap sacks and drowned in the Bosporus Strait. Now, obviously, that is a crazy story, but should it be believed? Well, the rule of thumb when it comes to stories of Ottoman excesses is to view them with some healthy suspicion. Specifically, Turkish historian Abdülkadir Dedoglu has challenged the veracity of many of these stories. The reason for this is that Ibrahim was eventually murdered in a palace coup, the same coup that would bring Mehmed IV, the Sultan in our story, to power. Now, the historian claims that the particularly salacious stories about Ibrahim were probably cooked up by his assassins to justify the murder. After all, murdering the Sultan was kind of a big deal. When Western historians got their hands on these stories, they somewhat uncritically repeated them as fact. You see, this brings me to a key point. Perhaps the largest myth that needs to be addressed is the Western myth about the Turks. You see, the stories about Ibrahim the Mad fit perfectly into European stereotypes about the Ottomans. By 1683, there had been a very old narrative about the Turks and the East in general that had been operating in Europe since ancient times. This was that Easterners were cruel, sex-obsessed, intemperate in their appetites, unthinking in their devotion to both religion and superstition, effeminate and greedy. Their success on the battlefield had only come because their leaders had an endless supply of brainwashed slaves that they could mindlessly throw at their enemies. Men like Ibrahim served as proof of a depravity that had infected an entire culture. As I've mentioned in other episodes, thinker Edward Said famously criticized this particular narrative about the East in his book Orientalism. He pointed out that for generations, Western literature emphasized aspects of Eastern culture that fit within this stereotype and neatly ignored those things that did not. Now, this was certainly true of the literature that was circulating in Europe leading up to the Siege of Vienna. These were the so-called Ottoman captivity narratives, which were basically romanticized memoirs of Europeans who had been captured by the Turks in battle and then sold into slavery. The most famous of these was the tale of Johann Schlitberger, a Bavarian noble who had been captured after the city of Nicopolis fell to the Turks in 1396. The story of his slavery at the hands of the Sultan, transfer to the service of Tamerlane, and eventual escape back to Europe would become a bit of a bestseller in the earliest days of the printing press. Most average Germans got what they knew about the Turks from Schlitberger. But here's the thing. Since the time of their publication, Schlitberger's accounts have been criticized again and again for being romantic, exaggerated, and often inaccurate. But in Renaissance Europe, this was basically taken to be unbiased reporting. His tale would essentially provide the archetype for dozens of other Ottoman captivity narratives, including the ripping yarn provided by our old buddy, Captain John Smith. As you might remember, Smith had his own romantic tale of escaping from Ottoman captivity that seemed to oddly mirror his later experience with Pocahontas. Head back to episode 35 if you want to hear more about that. All of these stories reinforced the same narrative about the Turks. They were cruel, they didn't care about human life, and they were bent on enslaving Christians. Historian Andrew Wheatcroft argues that the pictures in these books may have been even more influential than the actual stories. Even the illiterate could see images in Schlitberger's book of the evil Sultan looking on as Christian prisoners of Nicopolis were decapitated. Now, how true was this depiction of the Turks? Well, I had a teacher who once told me something about stereotypes. He said, "The thing about stereotypes isn't that they're untrue, it's that they're incomplete." In other words, a stereotype tells you one story about a group of people while leaving out all the other stories. It's not that that one story is untrue, it's just that it's been privileged above all others. As a result, the image you get of whoever is being stereotyped is distorted. In this case, it's fair to say that the Turks were a fearsome enemy and were unapologetic empire builders. They practiced slavery and were often remorseless to their defeated opponents. They were the authors of massacres and forced conversions. But let's not forget, the exact same things could be said of their European adversaries. In fact, in many ways, the Turks had a far more tolerant society than many of their contemporary European states. For instance, if you were a Jew or an Orthodox Christian, you had more rights living under the Ottomans than a Jew or a Muslim would have living under most European states of the same era. Again, this is not to say that the Turks were somehow especially warm and cuddly. Like their European adversaries, they were human. Both sides were capable of mercy and warmth, while also being capable of horrific acts of violence. The point is, in 1683, many Europeans did not have this nuanced view of their Turkish enemies. To them, the Turks were pure evil, and the pictures in the captivity narratives only served to confirm this. Andrew Wheatcroft puts it this way, quote, "The fear of the powerful and rapacious Turk knew no limitations or boundaries. English readers in 1683 were able to see an image of three Christians chained by the neck and pulling a plow, or earlier, men being dragged behind horses by Tartars. All these things happened, but not all the time and not to everyone. These disasters were part of life along the frontier, but they soon came to be seen as typical and universal. It was potent propaganda." End quote. In other words, they were presented as little better than the orcs from Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, evil creatures from a shadowy land bent on conquest. Although this was an unfair stereotype, you can't deny that conquest was something that the Ottomans were interested in. In 1683, the empire was now being run by a much more capable man than Ibrahim I. The Sultan Mehmed IV was a student of history and a lover of heroic romances. He was well aware of the achievements of his forebears. After all, his namesake Mehmed II had plucked the red apple of Constantinople and brought glory to the empire. Mehmed IV was looking to make his own mark on history, and his chief advisor, the Grand Vizier Kara Mustafa, was only too happy to encourage his sultan. Together, the two men devised a military campaign so grand that it would surely be remembered for generations. It was to be a bold and risky campaign that would involve the largest land army ever seen in Europe. Their goal would be the one prize that had eluded the great Suleiman. It wasn't long before word started spreading back in Europe. The orcs were on the move, and they were coming for the golden apple. Okay, that's all for this week. Join us again in 2 weeks' time when we will continue our exploration of the Siege of Vienna. Before we go this week, I want to remind all the Patreon subscribers to go and vote for the topic you want me to cover on the upcoming extra episode. Right now, Vlad the Impaler is ahead in the polls, but a good third of you still have not voted. So get in there. Let your voice be known. Right now is probably the best time ever to sign up for Patreon because you'll still get a chance to vote. Because the next time you hear my voice in 2 weeks, I'm going to announce what the extra episode will be. So if you sign up now, you can still go vote for the episode. And then when it comes out, you'll get it. No extra charge. It comes with just being a Patreon member at whatever level you choose to subscribe at. So it's a great time to get in on that. Speaking of Patreon, I've got to give a big fat shout out to Thomas, Alex McMurray, Tom Copel, Ms. Nix, Will S., Haley Ann Miller, and my man, Govan Kennedy, listening in the holy city of Jerusalem. Govan, I'm glad you're listening, buddy. Keep on rocking. Obviously, every single one of you is amazing because you have chosen to pledge $5 or more a month to keep this podcast going. And obviously, we've got an excellent reward coming for you very soon, the extra episode of your choosing. If you want to get in on Patreon, go to patreon.com/ourfakehistory and sign up now. You can also go to ourfakehistory.com. You can check out all the cool stuff we've got on our website there. Nice big versions of the art, as always provided for us by my man Frank Fiorentino. You can buy individual extra episodes there, or you can just do one-off pledges. You can also explore the archive and listen to all the back episodes. I should also let you know that there is going to be a live performance of Our Fake History. Yes, I'm going to be doing a thing with CBC Radio on their show Podcast Playlist on June 15th, that is June 15th, 2017, in Toronto at the Hot Docs Cinema. The show is basically going to be a live version of what Podcast Playlist normally does. The hosts Matt and Lindsay are going to be there, and a number of different podcasts are going to be on the show doing their thing live. And what do you know? One of them is Our Fake History. So if you live in the Toronto area and you want to see my mug in real life talking to you about fake history, then you should probably get yourself some tickets. So you can go to the Hot Docs website, you can go to cbc.ca, or you can go to facebook.com/ourfakehistory, where I will post a link for you to get tickets to the show. Honestly, guys, I am pumped about this. Come on, any Canadian out there listening knows that CBC is, it's kind of a big deal, and so I'm pretty pumped to be a part of this. In the meantime, if you want to reach out to me, you can get me at ourfakehistory@gmail.com. You can hit me up on Twitter at ourfakehistory, or you can go to the Facebook page that I said before, facebook.com/ourfakehistory. The theme music for the show comes to us from Dirty Church. You can check out Dirty Church at dirtychurch.bandcamp.com. All the other music you heard on the show today was written and recorded by me. My name is Sebastian Major, and remember, just because it didn't happen doesn't mean it isn't real.